Side 18. The Bachman Books. Four early novels. Continuing with The Running Man. On page 551. Richards sat still for a few minutes, then got up and walked over to the cop stationed by the door they had come in through. "Is there a telephone, pal?" He didn't expect they would be allowed to phone out, but the cop merely jerked his thumb toward the hall. Richards pushed the door open a crack and peered out. Sure enough, there it was. Payphone. He looked at the cop again. "Listen, if you loan me 50 cents for the phone, I'll..." "Screw off, Jack." Richards held his temper. "I want to call my wife. Our kid is sick. Put yourself in my place, for Christ's sake." The cop laughed, a short, chopping, ugly sound. "You types are all the same. A story for every day of the year. Technicolor in 3D on Christmas and Mother's Day." "You bastard," Richard said, and something in his eyes, the stance of his shoulders, suddenly made the cop shift his gaze to the wall. "Aren't you married yourself? Didn't you ever find yourself strapped and have to borrow, even if it tasted like shit in your mouth?" The cop suddenly jammed a hand into his jumper pocket and came up with a fistful of plastic coins. He thrust two new quarters at Richards, stuffed the rest of the money back in his pocket, and grabbed a handful of Richards' tunic. "If you send anybody else over here because Charlie Grady is a soft touch, I'll beat your son-of-a-bitching brains out, maggot." "Thank you," Richard said steadily, "for the loan." Charlie Grady laughed and let him go. Richards went out into the hall, picked up the phone, and dropped his money into the horn. It banged hollowly, and for a moment nothing happened. Oh, Jesus, all for nothing. But then the dial tone came. He punched the number of the fifth-floor hall phone slowly, hoping the Jenner bitch down the hall wouldn't answer. She'd just as soon yell wrong number when she recognized his voice and he would lose his money. It rang six times, and then an unfamiliar voice said, "Hello? I want to talk to Sheila Richards in 5C. "I think she went out," the voice said. It grew insinuating. "She walks up and down the block, you know. They got a sick kid. The man there is shiftless." "Just knock on the door," he said, cotton-mouthed. "Hold on." The phone on the other end crashed against the wall as the unfamiliar voice let it dangle. Far away, dim as if in a dream, he heard the unfamiliar voice knocking and yelling, "Phone! Phone for you, Mrs. Richards!" Half a minute later, the unfamiliar voice was back on the line. "She ain't there. I can hear the kid yelling, but she ain't there. Like I say, she keeps an eye out when the fleet's in." The voice giggled. Richards wished he could teleport himself through the phone line and pop out on the other end, like an evil genie from a black bottle, and choke the unfamiliar voice until his eyeballs popped out and rolled on the floor. "Take a message," he said. "Write it on the wall if you have to." "Ain't got no pencil. I'm hanging up. Goodbye." "Wait!" Richards yelled, panic in his voice. "I'm..." "Just a second," grudgingly the voice said. "She coming up the stairs now." Richards collapsed sweatily against the wall. A moment later, Sheila's voice was in his ear, quizzical, wary, a little frightened. "Hello?" "Sheila." He closed his eyes, letting the wall support him. "Ben. Ben, is that you? Are you all right?" "Yeah, fine. Kathy, is she..." "The same. The fever isn't so bad, but she sounds so croupy. Ben, I think there's water in her lungs. What if she has pneumonia?" "It'll be all right. It'll be all right. I..." She paused, a long pause. "I hate to leave her, but I had to. Ben, I turned two tricks this morning. I'm sorry, but I got her some medicine at the drug. Some good medicine." Her voice had taken on a zealous, evangelical lilt. "That stuff is shit," he said. "Listen, no more, Sheila. Please. I think I'm in here, really. They can't cut many more guys because there's too many shows. There's got to be enough cannon fodder to go around. And they give advances, I think. Mrs. Upshaw..." "She looked awful in black," Sheila broke in tonelessly. "Never mind that. You stay with Kathy, Sheila. No more tricks." "All right. I won't go out again." But he didn't believe her voice. "Fingers crossed, Sheila. I love you, Ben. And I love..." 3 minutes are up," the operator broke in. "If you wish to continue, please deposit one new quarter or three old quarters." "Wait a second," Richards yelled. "Get off the goddamn line, bitch, you..." The empty hum of a broken connection. He threw the receiver. It flew the length of its silver cord, then rebounded, striking the wall, and then penduluming slowly back and forth like some strange snake that had bitten once and then died. Somebody has to pay, Richards thought numbly as he walked back. Somebody has to. Minus 089 and counting. They were quartered on the fifth floor until 10 o'clock the following day, and Richards was nearly out of his mind with anger, worry, and frustration when a young and slightly faggoty-looking pal in a skin-tight games uniform asked them to please step into the elevator. They were perhaps 300 in all. Over 60 of their number had been removed soundlessly and painlessly the night before. One of them had been the kid with an inexhaustible fund of dirty jokes. They were taken to a small auditorium on the sixth floor in groups of 50. The auditorium was very luxurious, then in great quantities of red plush. There was an ashtray built into the real wood arm of every seat, and Richards hauled out his crumpled pack of blams. He tapped his ashes on the floor. There was a small stage at the front, and in the center of that, a lectern. A pitcher of water stood on it. At about 10:15, the faggoty-looking fellow walked to the lectern and said, "I'd like you to meet Arthur M. Burns, Assistant Director of Games." "Huzzah," somebody behind Richards said in a sour voice. A portly man with a tonsure surrounded by gray hair strode to the lectern, pausing and cocking his head as he arrived, as if to appreciate a round of applause which only he could hear. Then he smiled at them, a broad, twinkling smile that seemed to transform him into a pudgy, aging Cupid in a business suit. "Congratulations," he said. "You've made it." There was a huge collective sigh, followed by some laughter and backslapping. More cigarettes were lit up. "Huzzah," the sour voice repeated. "Shortly, your program assignments and seventh floor room numbers will be passed out. The executive producers of your particular programs will explain further exactly what is expected of you. But before that happens, I just want to repeat my congratulations and tell you that I find you to be a courageous, resourceful group, refusing to live on the public dole when you have means at your disposal to acquit yourselves as men, and may I add personally, as true heroes of our time." "Bullshit," the sour voice remarked. "Furthermore, I speak for the entire network when I wish you good luck and Godspeed." Arthur M. Burns chuckled porkily and rubbed his hands together. "Well, I know you're anxious to get those assignments, so I'll spare you any more of my jabber." A side door popped open, and a dozen games ushers wearing red tunics came into the auditorium. They began to call out names. White envelopes were passed out, and soon they littered the floor like confetti. Plastic assignment cards were read, exchanged with new acquaintances. There were muffled groans, cheers, catcalls. Arthur M. Burns presided over it all from his podium, smiling benevolently. "That Christly, how hot can you take it? Jesus, I hate the heat. The show's a goddamn too bitter. Comes on right after the flick tunes, for God's sake. Treadmill to bucks. Gosh, I didn't know my heart was... I was hoping I'd get it, but I didn't really think... Hey, Jake, you ever seen this Swim the Crocodiles? I thought..." "Nothing like I expected. I don't think you can..." "Miserable goddamn. This run for your guns... Benjamin Richards? Ben Richards? Here." He was handed a plain, white envelope and tore it open. His fingers were shaking slightly, and it took him two tries to get the small plastic card out. He frowned down at it, not understanding. No program assignment was punched on it. The card read simply, "Elevator 6. He put the card in his breast pocket with his ID and left the auditorium. The first five elevators at the end of the hall were doing a brisk business as they ferried the following week's contestants up to the seventh floor. There were four others standing by the closed doors of Elevator 6, and Richards recognized one of them as the owner of the sour voice. "What's this?" Richards asked. "Are we getting the gate?" The man with the sour voice was about 25, not bad looking. One arm was withered, probably by polio, which had come back strong in 2005. It had done especially well in co-op. "No such luck," he said, and laughed emptily. "I think we're getting the big money assignments. The ones where they do more than just land you in the hospital with a stroke, or put out an eye, or cut off an arm or two. The ones where they kill you. Prime time, baby." They were joined by a sixth pal, a good-looking kid who was blinking at everything in a surprised way. "Hello, sucker," the man with the sour voice said. At 11 o'clock, after all the others had been taken away, the doors of Elevator 6 popped open. There was a cop riding in the Judas hole again. "See," the man with the sour voice said, "we're dangerous characters, public enemies. They're gonna rub us out." He made a tough gangster face and sprayed the bulletproof compartment with an imaginary Sten gun. The cop stared at him woodenly. Minus 088 and counting. The waiting room on the eighth floor was very small, very plush, very intimate, very private. Richards had it all to himself. At the end of the elevator ride, three of them had been promptly whisked away down a plushly carpeted corridor by three cops. Richards, the man with the sour voice, and the kid who blinked a lot, had been taken here. A receptionist who vaguely reminded Richards of one of the old TV sex stars, Liz Kelly, Grace Taylor, he had watched as a kid, smiled at the three of them when they came in. She was sitting at a desk in an alcove, surrounded by so many potted plants that she might have been in an Ecuadorian foxhole. "Mr. Jansky," she said with a blinding smile, "go right in." The kid who blinked a lot went into the inner sanctum. Richards and the man with the sour voice, whose name was Jimmy Laughlin, made wary conversation. Richards discovered that Laughlin lived only three blocks away from him, on Dock Street. He had held a part-time job until the year before as an engine wiper for General Atomics, and had then been fired for taking part in a sit-down strike protesting leaky radiation shields. "Well, I'm alive anyway," he said. "According to those maggots, that's all that counts. I'm sterile, of course. That don't matter. That's one of the little risks you run for the princely sum of $7 a day." When G.A. had shown him the door, the withered arm had made it even tougher to get a job. His wife had come down with bad asthma 2 years before, was now bedridden. "Finally, I decided to go for the big brass ring," Laughlin said with a bitter smile. "Maybe I'll get a chance to push a few creeps out a high window before McCone's boys get me." "Do you think it really is?" "The running man? Bet your sweet ass. Give me one of those cruddy cigarettes, pal." Richards gave him one. The door opened and the kid who blinked a lot came out on the arm of a beautiful dolly wearing two handkerchiefs and a prayer. The kid gave them a small nervous smile as they went by. "Mr. Laughlin, would you go in, please?" So Richards was alone, unless you counted the receptionist who had disappeared into her foxhole again. He got up and went over to the free cigarette machine in the corner. Laughlin must be right, he reflected. The cigarette machine dispensed dokes. They must have hit the big leagues. He got a package of blams, sat down, and lit one up. About 20 minutes later, Laughlin came out with an ash blonde on his arm. "A friend of mine from the carpool," he said to Richards, and pointed at the blonde. She dimpled dutifully. Laughlin looked pained. "At least the bastard talks straight," he said to Richards. "See you." He went out. The receptionist poked her head out of the foxhole. "Mr. Richards, would you step in, please?" He went in. Minus 087 and counting. The inner office looked big enough to play killball in. It was dominated by a huge one-wall picture window that looked west over the homes of the middle class, the dockside warehouses and oil tanks, and Harding Lake itself. Both sky and water were pearl gray. It was still raining. A large tanker far out was chugging from right to left. The man behind the desk was of middle height and very black, so black, in fact, that for a moment Richards was struck with unreality. He might have stepped out of a minstrel show. "Mr. Richards." He rose and extended his hand over the desk. When Richards did not shake it, he did not seem particularly flustered. He merely took his hand back to himself and sat down. A sling chair was next to the desk. Richard sat down and butted his smoke in an ashtray with the game's emblem embossed on it. "I'm Dan Killian, Mr. Richards. By now you've probably guessed why you've been brought here. Our records and your test scores both say you're a bright boy." Richards folded his hands and waited. "You've been slated as a contestant on The Running Man, Mr. Richards. It's our biggest show. It's the most lucrative and dangerous for the men involved. I've got your final consent form here on my desk. I've no doubt that you'll sign it, but first I want to tell you why you've been selected, and I want you to understand fully what you're getting into." Richards said nothing. Killian pulled a dossier onto the virgin surface of his desk blotter. Richard saw that it had his name typed on the front. Killian flipped it open. "Benjamin Stewart Richards, age 28, born August 8, 1997, city of Harding. Attended South City Manual Trades from September of 2011 until December of 2013. Suspended twice for failure to respect authority. I believe you kicked the assistant principal in the upper thigh once while his back was turned." "Crap," Richard said. "I kicked him in the ass." Killian nodded. "However you say, Mr. Richards. You married Sheila Richards, nay Gordon, at the age of 16. Old-style lifetime contract. Rebel all the way, huh? No union affiliation due to your refusal to sign the union oath of fealty and the wage control articles. I believe that you referred to Area Governor Johnsbury as a cornholing son of a bitch." "Yes," Richard said. "Your work record has been spotty and you've been fired, let's see, a total of 6 times for such things as insubordination, insulting superiors, and abusive criticism of authority." Richard shrugged. "In short, you are regarded as anti-authoritarian and antisocial. You're a deviant who has been intelligent enough to stay out of prison in serious trouble with the government, and you're not hooked on anything. A staff psychologist reports you saw lesbians, excrement, and a pollutive gas vehicle in various ink blots. He also reports a high, unexplained degree of hilarity. He reminded me of a kid I used to know. He liked to hide under the bleachers at school and whack off. The kid, I mean. I don't know what your doctor likes to do." "I see." Killian smiled briefly, white teeth glittering in all that darkness, and went back to his folder. "You held racial responses outlawed by the Racial Act of 2004. You made several rather violent responses during the word association test." "I'm here on violent business," Richard said. "To be sure. And yet we... And here I speak in a larger sense than the Games Authority. I speak in the national sense. View these responses with extreme disquiet. Afraid someone might tape a stick of Irish to your ignition system some night?" Richards asked, grinning. Killian wet his thumb reflectively and turned to the next sheet. "Fortunately for us, you've given a hostage to fortune, Mr. Richards. You have a daughter named Catherine, 18 months. Was that a mistake?" He smiled frostily. "Planned," Richards said without rancor. "I was working for GA then. Somehow some of my sperm lived through it. A jest of God, maybe. With the world the way it is, I sometimes think we must have been off our trolley." "At any rate, you're here," Killian said, continuing to smile his cold smile. "And next Tuesday, you will appear on The Running Man. You've seen the program?" "Yes." "Then you know it's the biggest thing going on Freevee. It's filled with chances for viewer participation, both vicarious and actual. I am executive producer of the program."
"That's really wonderful," Richard said.
"The program is one of the surest ways the network has of getting rid of embryo troublemakers such as yourself, Mr. Richards. We've been on for 6 years. To date, we have no survivals. To be brutally honest, we expect to have none." "Then you're running a crooked table," Richards said flatly. Killian seemed more amused than horrified. "But we're not. You keep forgetting you're an anachronism, Mr. Richards. People won't be in the bars and hotels or gathering in the cold in front of appliance stores rooting for you to get away. Goodness, no. They want to see you wiped out. And they'll help if they can. The more messy, the better. And there is McCone to contend with. Evan McCone and the Hunters." "They sound like a neo group," Richard said. "McCone never loses," Killian said. Richards grunted. "You'll appear live Tuesday night. Subsequent programs will be a patch-up of tapes, films, and live tricasts when possible. We've been known to interrupt scheduled broadcasting when a particularly resourceful contestant is on the verge of reaching his personal Waterloo, shall we say. The rules are simplicity themselves. You, or your surviving family, will win $100 new for each hour you remain free. We stake you to $4,800 running money, on the assumption that you will be able to fox the Hunters for 48 hours.
The unspent balance, refundable, of course, if you fall before the 48 hours are up. You're given a 12-hour head start. If you last 30 days, you'll win the grand prize. $1 billion. Richards threw back his head and laughed. My sentiments exactly, Killian said with a dry smile. Do you have any questions?
Just one, Richards said, leaning forward. The traces of humor had vanished from his face completely. How would you like to be the one out there on the run?
Killian laughed. He held his belly and huge mahogany laughter rolled richly in the room. Oh, Mr. Richards, you must excuse me. And he went off into another gale. At last, dabbing his eyes with a large white handkerchief, Killian seemed to get himself under control. You see, not only are you possessed of a sense of humor, Mr. Richards, He choked new laughter down. Please excuse me. You've struck my funny bone. I see I have. Other questions? No. Very good. There will be a staff meeting before the program. If any questions should develop in that fascinating mind of yours, please hold them until then. Killian pressed a button on his desk. Spare me the cheap snatch, Richard said. I'm married. Killian's eyebrows went up. Are you quite sure? Fidelity is admirable, Mr. Richards, but it's a long time from Friday to Tuesday. And considering the fact that you may never see your wife again, I'm married. Very well. He nodded to the girl in the doorway, and she disappeared. Anything we can do for you, Mr. Richards? You'll have a private suite on the 9th floor, and meal requests will be filled within reason. A good bottle of bourbon, and a telephone so I can talk to my Ah, no, I'm sorry, Mr. Richards. The bourbon we can do, but once you sign this release form, he pushed it over to Richards along with a pen, you're incommunicado until Tuesday. Would you care to reconsider the girl? No, Richards said, and scrawled his name on the dotted line. But you better make that 2 bottles of bourbon. Certainly. Killian stood and offered his hand again. Richards disregarded it again and walked out. Killian looked after him, and with blank eyes. He was not smiling. -086, and counting. The receptionist popped promptly out of her foxhole as Richards walked through and handed him an envelope on the front. Mr. Richards, I suspect one of the things that you will not mention during our interview is the fact that you need money badly right now. Is it not true? Despite rumors to the contrary, Games Authority does not give advances. You must not look upon yourself as a contestant with all the glitter that word entails. You are not a freebie star, but only a working Joe who is being paid extremely well for undertaking a dangerous job. However, Games Authority has no rule which forbids me from extending you a personal loan. Inside, you will find 10% of your advance salary. Not in new dollars, I should caution you, but in games certificates redeemable for dollars. Should you decide to send these certificates to your wife, as I suspect you will, she will find they have one advantage over new dollars. A reputable doctor will accept them as legal tender, while a quack will not. Sincerely, Dan Killian. Richards opened the envelope and pulled out a thick book of coupons with the game symbol on the vellum cover. Inside were 48 coupons with a face value of $10 each. Richards felt an absurd wave of gratitude toward Killian sweep him and crushed it. He had no doubt that Killian would attach $480 of his advance money. And besides that, $480 was a pretty goddamn cheap price to pay for insurance on the big show, the continued happiness of the client, and Killian's own big-money job. Shit, he said. The receptionist poked attentively out of her foxhole. Did you say something, Mr. Richards? No. Which way to the elevators? -085, and counting. The suite was sumptuous. Wall-to-wall carpeting, almost deep enough to breaststroke in, covered the floors of all 3 rooms, living room, bedroom, and bath. The freebie was turned off. Blessed silence prevailed. There were flowers in the vases, and on the wall next to the door was a button discreetly marked, Service. The service would be fast, too, Richards thought cynically.
There were two cops stationed outside his ninth floor suite just to make sure he didn't go wandering. He pushed the service button and the door opened. "Yes, Mr. Richards," one of the cops said. Richards fancied he could see how sour that Mr. tasted in his mouth. "The bourbon you asked for will be..." "It's not that," Richards said. He showed the cop the book of coupons Killian had left for him. "I want you to take this somewhere. Just write the name and address, Mr. Richards, and I'll see that it's delivered." Richards found the cobbler's receipt and wrote his address and Sheila's name on the back of it. He gave the tattered paper and the coupon book to the cop. He was turning away when a new thought struck Richards. "Hey, just a second." The cop turned back, and Richards plucked the coupon book out of his hand. He opened it to the first coupon and tore one-tenth of it along the perforated line. Equivalent value, one new dollar. "Do you know a cop named Charlie Grady?"
"Charlie?"
The cop looked at him warily.
"Yeah, I know Charlie. He's got fifth floor duty."
"Give him this." Richards handed him the coupon section. "Tell him the extra 50 cents is his usurer's fee." The cop turned away again, and Richards called him back once more. "You'll bring me written receipts from my wife and from Grady, won't you?" Disgust showed openly on the cop's face.
"Ain't you the trusting soul?"
"Sure," Richard said, smiling thinly. "You guys taught me that. South of the canal, you taught me all about it." "It's going to be fun," the cop said, "watching them go after you. I'm going to be glued to my freebie with a beer in each hand."
"Just bring me the receipts," Richard said, and closed the door gently in the cop's face.
The bourbon came 20 minutes later, and Richards told the surprised delivery man that he would like a couple of thick novels sent up.
"Novels?"
"Books, you know, read, words, movable press," Richard pantomimed, flipping pages.
"Yes, sir," he said doubtfully.
"Do you have a dinner order?"
Christ, the shit was getting thick. He was drowning in it.
Richard saw a sudden fantasy cartoon. Man falls into outhouse hole and drowns in pink shit that smells like Chanel No. 5. The kicker, it still tastes like shit. "Steak, peas, mashed potatoes."
God, what was Sheila sitting down to? A protein pill and a cup of fake coffee?
"Milk, apple cobbler with cream. Got it?"
"Yes, sir. Would you like..."
"No," Richard said, suddenly distraught. "No, get out."
He had no appetite. Absolutely none.
Minus 084 and counting. With sour amusement, Richards thought that the games bellboy had taken him literally about the novels. He must have picked them out with a ruler as his only guide. Anything over an inch and a half is okay. He had brought Richards three books he had never heard of. Two golden oldies titled God is an Englishman and Not as a Stranger, and a huge tome written 3 years ago called The Pleasure of Serving. Richards peeked into that one first and wrinkled his nose. Poor boy makes good in General Atomics. Rises from engine wiper to gear tradesman. Takes night courses. On what, Richards wondered? Monopoly money? Falls in love with beautiful girl. Apparently syphilis hadn't rotted her nose off yet. At a block orgy. Promoted to junior technico following dazzling aptitude scores. 3-year marriage contract follows and... Richards threw the book across the room. God is an Englishman was a little better. He poured himself a bourbon on the rocks and settled into the story. By the time the discreet knock came, he was 300 pages in, and pretty well in the bag to boot. One of the bourbon bottles was empty. He went to the door holding the other in his hand. The cop was there. "Your receipts, Mr. Richards," he said, and pulled the door closed. Sheila had not written anything, but had sent one of Kathy's baby pictures. He looked at it and felt the easy tears of drunkenness prick his eyes. He put it in his pocket and looked at the other receipt. Charlie Grady had written briefly on the back of a traffic ticket form, "Thanks, maggot. Get stuffed, Charlie Grady." Richard snickered and let the paper flitter to the carpet. "Thanks, Charlie," he said to the empty room. "I needed that." He looked at the picture of Kathy again, a tiny red-faced infant of 4 days at the time of the photo, screaming her head off, swimming in a white cradle dress that Sheila had made herself. He felt the tears lurking and made himself think of good old Charlie's thank-you note.
He wondered if he could kill the entire second bottle before he passed out, and decided to find out. He almost made it. -083 and counting. Richard spent Saturday living through a huge hangover. He was almost over it by Saturday evening, and ordered two more bottles of bourbon with supper. He got through both of them and woke up in the pale early light of Sunday morning, seeing large caterpillars with flat murderous eyes crawling slowly down the far bedroom wall. He decided then it would be against his best interests to wreck his reactions completely before Tuesday and laid off the booze. This hangover was slower dissipating. He threw up a good deal, and when there was nothing left to throw up, he had dry heaves. These tapered off around 6 o'clock Sunday evening, and he ordered soup for dinner, no bourbon. He asked for a dozen neo-rock discers to play on the sweet sound system, and tired of them quickly. He went to bed early, and slept poorly. He spent most of Monday on the tiny glassed-in terrace that opened off the bedroom. He was very high above the waterfront now, and the day was a series of sun and showers that was fairly pleasant. He read two novels, went to bed early again, and slept a little better. There was an unpleasant dream. Sheila was dead, and he was at her funeral. Somebody had propped her up in her coffin and stuffed a grotesque corsage of new dollars in her mouth. He tried to run to her and remove the obscenity. Hands grabbed him from behind. He was being held by a dozen cops. One of them was Charlie Grady. He was grinning and saying, "This is what happens to losers, maggot." They were putting their pistols to his head when he woke up. "Tuesday," he said to no one at all, and rolled out of bed. The fashionable GA sunburst clock on the far wall said it was 7:09. The live tricast of the running man would be going out all over North America in less than 11 hours. He felt a hot drop of fear in his stomach. In 23 hours, he would be fair game. He had a long hot shower, dressed in his coverall, ordered ham and eggs for breakfast. He also got the bellboy on duty to send up a carton of blams. He spent the rest of the morning and early afternoon reading quietly. It was 2 o'clock on the nose when a single formal rap came at the door. Three police and Arthur M. Burns, looking potty and more than a bit ridiculous in a games singlet, walked in. All of the cops were carrying move-alongs. "It's time for your final briefing, Mr. Richards," Burns said. "Would you?" "Sure," Richards said. He marked his place in the book he had been reading and put it down on the coffee table. He was suddenly terrified, close to panic, and he was very glad there was no perceptible shake in his fingers. -082 and counting. The 10th floor of the games building was a great deal different from the ones below, and Richards knew that he was meant to go no higher. The fiction of upward mobility, which started in the grimy street-level lobby, ended here on the 10th floor. This was the broadcast facility. The hallways were wide, white, and stark. Bright yellow go-karts, powered by GA solar cell motors, pottered here and there, carrying loads of Freevee Technicos to studios and control rooms. A cart was waiting for them when the elevator stopped, and the five of them, Richards, Burns, and Copps, climbed aboard. Necks craned, and Richards was pointed out several times as they made the trip. One woman in a yellow games shorts and halter outfit winked and blew Richards a kiss. He gave her the finger. They seemed to travel miles through dozens of interconnecting corridors. Richards caught glimpses into at least a dozen studios, one of them containing the infamous treadmill seen on Treadmill to Bucks. A tour group from uptown was trying it out and giggling. At last, they came to a stop before a door which read, "The Running Man, Absolutely No Admittance." Burns waved to the guard in the bulletproof booth beside the door, and then looked at Richards. "Put your ID in the slot between the guard booth and the door," Burns said. Richards did it. His card disappeared into the slot, and a small light went on in the guard booth. The guard pushed a button, and the door slid open. Richards got back into the cart, and they were trundled into the room beyond. "Where's my card?" Richards asked. "You don't need it anymore." They were in the control room. The console section was empty except for a bald technico who was sitting in front of a blank monitor screen reading numbers into a microphone. Across to the left, Dan Killian and two men Richards hadn't met
were sitting around a table with frosted glasses. One of them was vaguely familiar, too pretty to be a Technico. "Hello, Mr. Richards.
Hello, Arthur.
Would you care for a soft drink, Mr. Richards?" Richards found he was thirsty. It was quite warm on 10, in spite of the many air-conditioning units he had seen. "I'll have a Rooty Toot," he said. Killian rose, went to a cold cabinet, and snapped the lid from a plastic squeeze bottle. Richards sat down and took the bottle with a nod. "Mr. Richards, this gentleman on my right is Fred Victor, the director of the Running Man. This other fellow, as I'm sure you know, is Bobby Thompson." Thompson, of course. Host and MC of the Running Man. He wore a natty green tunic, slightly iridescent, and sported a mane of hair that was silvery attractive enough to be suspect. "Do you diet?" Richards asked. Thompson's impeccable eyebrows went up. "I beg pardon?" "Never mind," Richards said. "You'll have to make allowances for Mr. Richards," Killian said, smiling. "He seems afflicted with an extreme case of the roods." "Quite understandable," Thompson said, and lit a cigarette. Richards felt a wave of unreality surge over him. "Under the circumstances." "Come over here, Mr. Richards, if you please," Victor said, taking charge. He led Richards to the bank of screens on the other side of the room. The Technico had finished with his numbers and had left the room. Victor punched two buttons, and left-right views of the Running Man set sprang into view. "We don't do a run-through here," Victor said. "We think it detracts from spontaneity. Bobby just wings it, and he does a pretty damn good job. We go on at 6 o'clock, Harding time. Bobby is in center stage on that raised blue dais. He does the lead-in, giving a rundown on you. The monitor will flash a couple of still pictures. You'll be in the wings at stage right, flanked by two games guards. They'll come on with you, armed with riot guns. Move-alongs would be more practical if you decided to give trouble, but the riot guns are good theater." "Sure," Richard said. "There'll be a lot of booing from the audience. We pack it that way because it's good theater, just like the kill ball matches." "Are they going to shoot me with fake bullets?" Richards asked. "You could put a few blood bags on me to spatter on cue. That would be good theater, too." "Pay attention, please," Victor said. "You and the guards go on when your name is called. Bobby will interview you. Feel free to express yourself as colorfully as you please. It's all good theater. Then around 6:10, just before the first network promo, you'll be given your stake money and exit, sans guards, at stage left. You understand?" "Yes. What about Laughlin?" Victor frowned and lit a cigarette. "He comes on after you at 6:15. We run two contests simultaneously because often one of the contestants is inept at staying ahead of the hunters. With the kid as a backup?" "Mr. Jansky, yes, but none of this concerns you, Mr. Richards. When you exit stage left, you'll be given a tape machine, which is about the size of a box of popcorn. It weighs 6 pounds. With it, you'll be given 60 tape clips, which are about 4 inches long. The equipment will fit inside a coat pocket without a bulge. It's a triumph of modern technology." "Swell." Victor pressed his lips together. "As Dan has already told you, Richards, you're a contestant only for the masses. Actually, you are a working man, and you should view your role in that light. The tape cartridges can be dropped into any mail slot, and they will be delivered express to us so we can edit them for airing that night. Failure to deposit 2 clips per day will result in legal default of payment." "But I'll still be hunted down." "Right, so mail those tapes. They won't give away your location. The hunters operate independently of the broadcasting section." Richards had his doubts about that, but said nothing. "After we give you the equipment, you will be escorted to the street elevator. This gives directly on Rampart Street. Once you're there, you're on your own." He paused. "Questions?" "No." "Then Mr. Killian has one more money detail to straighten out with you." They walked back to where Dan Killian was in conversation with Arthur M. Burns. Richards asked for another Rooty Toot and got it. "Mr. Richards," Killian said, twinkling his teeth at him. "As you know, you leave the studio unarmed, but this is not to say you cannot arm yourself by fair means or foul. Goodness, no. You or your estate will be paid an additional $100 for any hunter or representative of the law you should happen to dispatch." "I know, don't tell me," Richard said. "It's good theater." Killian smiled delightedly. "How very astute of you. Yes. However, try not to bag any innocent bystanders. That's not kosher." Richard said nothing. "The other aspect of the program,"
The Stooleys and independent cameramen, I know. They're not Stooleys, they're good North American citizens. It was difficult to tell whether Killian's tone of hurt was real or ironic. Anyway, there's an 800 number for anyone who spots you. A verified sighting pays $100 new. A sighting which results in a kill pays $1,000. We pay independent cameramen $10 a foot and up. Retire to scenic Jamaica on blood money, Richards cried, spreading his arms wide. Get your picture on 100 3D weeklies. Be the idol of millions. Just holograph for details. That's enough, Killian said quietly. Bobby Thompson was buffing his fingernails. Victor had wandered out and could be faintly heard yelling at someone about camera angles. Killian pressed a button. Miss Jones, ready for you, sweets. He stood up and offered his hand again. Make up next, Mr. Richards, then the lighting runs. You'll be quartered off stage and we won't meet again before you go on, so? It's been grand, Richards said. He declined the hand. Miss Jones led him up. It was 2:30. -081 and counting. Richards stood in the wings with a cop on each side, listening to the studio audience as they frantically applauded Bobby Thompson. He was nervous. He jeered at himself for it, but the nervousness was a fact. Jeering would not make it go away. It was 6:01. Tonight's first contestant is a shrewd, resourceful man from south of the canal in our own home city, Thompson was saying. The monitor faded to a stark portrait of Richards in his baggy gray work shirt, taken by a hidden camera days before. The background looked like the fifth-floor waiting room. It had been retouched, Richards thought, to make his eyes deeper, his forehead a little lower, his cheeks more shadowed. His mouth had been given a jeering, curled expression by some technico's airbrush. All in all, the Richards on the monitor was terrifying. The angel of urban death, brutal, not very bright, but possessed of a certain primitive animal cunning. The uptown apartment dweller's boogeyman. This man is Benjamin Richards, age 28. Know the face well. In a half hour, this man will be on the prowl. A verified sighting brings you $100 new. A sighting which results in a kill results in $1,000 new for you. Richards's mind was wandering. It came back to the point with a mighty snap. And this is the woman that Benjamin Richards' award will go to, if and when he is brought down. The picture dissolved to a still of Sheila, but the airbrush had been at work again, this time wielded with a heavier hand. The results were brutal. The sweet, not-so-good-looking face had been transformed into that of a vapid slattern. Full pouting lips, eyes that seemed to glitter with avarice, a suggestion of a double chin fading down to what appeared to be bare breasts. You bastard, Richards grated. He lunged forward, but powerful arms held him back. Simmer down, buddy, it's only a picture. A moment later, he was half led, half dragged on stage. The audience reaction was immediate. The studio was filled with screamed cries of, Boo, psycho bum! Get out, you creep! Kill him, kill the bastard! You eat it! Get out, get out! Bobby Thompson held his arms up and shouted good-naturedly for quiet. Let's hear what he's got to say. The audience quieted, but reluctantly. Richards stood bull-like under the hot lights with his head lowered. He knew he was projecting exactly the aura of hate and defiance that they wanted him to project, but he could not help it. He stared at Thompson with hard, red-rimmed eyes. Somebody is going to eat their own balls for that picture of my wife, he said. Speak up, Mr. Richards, Thompson cried with just the right note of contempt. Nobody will hurt you, at least not yet. More screams and hysterical vituperation from the audience. Richards suddenly wheeled to face them, and they quieted as if slapped. Women stared at him with frightened, half-sexual expressions. Men grinned up at him with blood hate in their eyes. You bastards, he cried. If you want to see somebody die so bad, why don't you kill each other? His final words were drowned in more screams. People from the audience, perhaps paid to do so, were trying to get on stage. The police were holding them back. Richards faced them, knowing how he must look. Thank you, Mr. Richards, for those words of wisdom. The contempt was palpable now, and the crowd, nearly silent again, was eating it up. Would you like to tell our audience in the studio and at home how long you think you can hold out? I want to tell everybody in the studio and at home that that wasn't my wife. That was a cheap fake. The crowd drowned him out. Their screams of hate had reached a near fever pitch.
Thompson waited nearly a minute for them to quiet a little, then repeated, "How long do you expect to hold out, Mr. Richards?"
"I expect to go the whole 30," Richards said coolly. "I don't think you've got anybody who can take me."
More screaming, shaken fists. Someone threw a tomato. Bobby Thompson faced the audience again and cried, "With those last cheap words of bravado, Mr. Richards will be led from our stage. Tomorrow at noon, the hunt begins. Remember his face. It may be next to you on a pneumo bus, in a jet plane, at a 3D rack, in your local killball arena. Tonight he's in Harding. Tomorrow in New York, Boise, Albuquerque, Columbus, skulking outside your home. Will you report him?" "Yes," they screamed. Richard suddenly gave them the finger, both fingers. This time the rush for the stage was by no stretch of the imagination simulated. Richards was rushed out the stage left exit before they could rip him apart on camera, thus depriving the network of all the juicy upcoming coverage. Minus 080 and counting. Killian was in the wings and convulsed with amusement. "Fine performance, Mr. Richards. Fine! God, I wish I could give you a bonus. Those fingers, superb!" "We aim to please," Richards said. The monitors were dissolving to a promo. "Give me the goddamn camera and go fuck yourself."
"That's generically impossible," Killian said, still grinning. "But here's the camera."
He took it from the technico who had been cradling it. "Fully loaded and ready to go. And here are the clips." He handed Richards a small, surprisingly heavy, oblong box wrapped in oilcloth. Richards dropped the camera into one coat pocket, the clips into the other. "Okay, where's the elevator?"
"Not so fast," Killian said.
"You've got a minute, 12 of them, actually. Your 12 hours leeway doesn't start officially until 6:30. The screams of rage had begun again. Looking over his shoulder, Richard saw that Laughlin was on. His heart went out to him.
"I like you, Richards, and I think you'll do well," Killian said.
"You have a certain crude style that I enjoy immensely. I'm a collector, you know. Cave art and Egyptian artifacts are my areas of specialization. You are more analogous to the cave art than to my Egyptian urns, but no matter. I wish you could be preserved, collected, if you please, just as my Asian cave paintings have been collected and preserved."
"Grab a recording of my brainwaves, you bastard. They're on record."
"So I'd like to give you a piece of advice," Killian said, ignoring him. "You don't really have a chance. Nobody does, with a whole nation in on the manhunt, and with the incredibly sophisticated equipment and training that the hunters have. But if you stay low, you'll last longer. Use your legs instead of any weapons you happen to pick up, and stay close to your own people." He leveled a finger at Richards in emphasis. "Not these good middle-class folks out there. They hate your guts. You symbolize all the fears of this dark and broken time. It wasn't all show and audience packing out there, Richards. They hate your guts. Could you feel it?"
"Yes," Richards said. "I felt it. I hate them, too."
Killian smiled. "That's why they're killing you."
He took Richards' arm. His grip was surprisingly strong.
"This way." Behind them, Laughlin was being ragged by Bobby Thompson to the audience's satisfaction. Down a white corridor, their footfalls echoing hollowly, alone, all alone. One elevator at the end.
"This is where you and I part company," Killian said.
"Express to the street. 9 seconds. He offered his hand for the fourth time, and Richards refused it again. Yet he lingered a moment. "What if I could go up?" he asked, and gestured with his head toward the ceiling and the 80 stories above the ceiling. "Who could I kill up there? Who could I kill if I went right to the top?" Killian laughed softly and punched the button beside the elevator. The doors popped open.
"That's what I like about you, Richards. You think big."
Richards stepped into the elevator. The doors slid toward each other.
"Stay low," Killian repeated.
And then Richards was alone. The bottom dropped out of his stomach as the elevator sank toward the street. Minus 079 and counting. The elevator opened directly onto the street. A cop was standing by its frontage on Nixon Memorial Park, but he did not look at Richards as he stepped out, only tapped his move along reflectively and stared into the soft drizzle that filled the air. The drizzle had brought early dusk to the city. The lights glowed mystically through the darkness, and the people moving on Rampart Street in the shadow of the Games building were only insubstantial shadows, as Richard knew he must be himself. He breathed deeply of the wet, sulfur-tainted air. It was good in spite of the taste. It seemed that he had just been let out of prison, rather than from one communicating cell to another. The air was good, the air was fine. "Stay close to your own people," Killian had said. Of course he was right. Richards hadn't needed Killian to tell him that, or to know that the heat would be heaviest in Co-op City when the truce broke at noon tomorrow. But by then he would be over the hills and far away. He walked 3 blocks and hailed a taxi. He was hoping the cab's freebie would be busted, a lot of them were, but this one was in A1 working order and blaring the closing credits of The Running Man. Shit. "Where, buddy?" Robard Street. That was 5 blocks from his destination. When the cab dropped him, he would go Backyard Express to Moley's place. The cab accelerated, ancient gas-powered engine, a discordant symphony of pounding pistons and manifold noise. Richard slumped back against the vinyl cushions into what he hoped was deeper shadow.
"Hey, I just seen you on the freebie,"
the cabbie exclaimed.
"You're that guy Pritchard."
"Pritchard, that's right," Richard said resignedly. The Games building was dwindling behind them. A psychological shadow seemed to be dwindling proportionally in his mind, in spite of the bad luck with the cabbie.
"Jesus, you got balls, buddy, I'll say that. You really do. Christ, they'll kill you. You know that? They'll kill you fucking eye dead. You must really have balls."
"That's right, 2 of them, just like you."
"2 of them?
The cabbie repeated. He was ecstatic.
"Jesus, that's good. That's hot. You mind if I tell my wife I had you as a fare? She goes batshit for the Games. I have to report you, too, but Christ, I won't get no 100 for it. Cabby's got to have at least one supporting witness, you know. Knowing my luck, no one saw you getting in."
"That would be tough," Richard said. "I'm sorry you can't help kill me. Should I leave a note saying I was here?"
"Jesus, could you? That'd be..."
They had just crossed the canal. "Let me out here," Richard said abruptly. He pulled a new dollar from the envelope Thompson had handed him and dropped it on the front seat.
"Gee, I didn't say nothing, did I? I didn't mean to..."
"No," Richard said.
"Could you give me that note?"
"Get stuffed, maggot." He lunged out and began walking toward Drummond Street. Co-op City rose skeletal in the gathering darkness before him. The cabbie's yell floated after him.
"I hope they get you early, you cheap fuck."
-078 and counting. Through a backyard, through a ragged hole in a cyclone fence separating one barren asphalt desert from another, across a ghostly abandoned construction site, pausing far back in shattered shadows as a cycle pack roared by, headlamps glaring in the dark like the psychopathic eyes of nocturnal werewolves. Then over a final fence, cutting one hand, and he was rapping on Moley Jernigan's back door, which is to say the main entrance. Moley ran a Dock Street hock shop where a fellow with enough bucks to spread around could buy a police special move along, a full choke riot gun, a submachine gun, heroin, push, cocaine, drag disguises, a Styroflex pseudo-woman, a real whore if you were too strapped to afford Styroflex, the current address of one of 3 floating crap games, the current address on a swinging perverto club, or 100 other illegal items. If Moley didn't have what you wanted, he would order it for you, including false papers. When he opened the peephole and saw who was there, he offered a kindly smile and said, "Why don't you go away, pal? I never saw you." "New dollars," Richards remarked, as if to the air itself. There was a pause. Richards studied the cuff of his shirt as if he had never seen it before. Then the bolts and locks were opened quickly, as if Moley were afraid Richards would change his mind. Richards came in. They were in Moley's place behind the store, which was a rat warren of old newsies, stolen musical instruments, stolen cameras, and boxes of black market groceries. Moley was, by necessity, something of a Robin Hood. A pawnbroker south of the canal did not remain in business long if he became too greedy. Moley took the rich uptown maggots as heavily as he could and sold in the neighborhood at close to cost, sometimes lower than cost if some pal was being squeezed hard. Thus, his reputation in Co-op City was excellent, his protection superb. If a cop asked a South City stoolie, and there were hundreds of them, about Moley Jernigan, the informant let it be known that Moley was a slightly senile old-timer who took a little graft and sold a little black market. Any number of uptown swells with strange sexual tendencies could have told the police differently, but there were no vice busts anymore. Everyone knew vice was bad for any real revolutionary climate. The fact that Moley also ran a moderately profitable trade in forged documents, strictly for local customers, was unknown uptown. Still, Richards knew, tooling papers for someone as hot as he was would be extremely dangerous.
What papers?
Moley asked, sighing deeply and turning on an ancient gooseneck lamp that flooded the working area of his desk with bright white light. He was an old man, approaching 75, and in the close glow of the light, his hair looked like spun silver. Driver's license, military service card, street identity card, axial charge card, social retirement card. Easy. $60 job for anyone but you, Benny.
You'll do it?
For your wife, I'll do it. For you, no. I don't put my head in the noose for any crazy-ass bastard like Benny Richards.
How long, Moley?
Moley's eyes flashed sardonically.
Knowing your situation as I do, I'll hurry it. An hour for each.
Christ, 5 hours.
Can I go?
No, you can't.
Are you nuts, Benny?
A cop comes pulling up to your development last week.
He's got an envelope for your old lady.
He came in a black wagon with about 6 buddies. Flapper Donegan was standing on the corner pitching nicks with Jerry Hanrahan when it transpired. Flapper tells me everything. The boy's soft, you know.
I know Flapper's soft, Richard said impatiently. I sent the money. Is she...
Who knows?
Who sees?
Moley shrugged and rolled his eyes as he put pens and blank forms in the center of the pool of light thrown by the lamp.
They're 4 deep around your building, Benny. Anyone who's sent to offer their condolences would end up in a cellar talking to a bunch of rubber clubs. Even good friends don't need that scam, not even with your old lady flush. You got a name you want special on these?
Doesn't matter as long as it's Anglo. Jesus, Moley, she must have come out for groceries. And the doctor?
She sent Budgio Sanchez's kid.
What's his name?
Walt.
Yeah, that's it. I can't keep the goddamn spicks and micks straight no more.
I'm getting senile, Benny. Blowing my cool.
He glared up at Richards suddenly.
I remember when Mick Jagger was a big name. You don't even know who he was, do you?
I know who he was, Richards said, distraught. He turned to Moley's sidewalk-level window, frightened. It was worse than he thought. Sheila and Kathy were in the cage, too, at least until...
They're okay, Benny.
Moley said softly.
Just stay away. You're poison to them now. Can you dig it?
Yes, Richard said. He was suddenly overwhelmed with despair, black and awful. I'm homesick, he thought, amazed. But it was more. It was worse. Everything seemed out of whack, surreal. The very fabric of existence, bulging at the seams. Faces whirling. Laughlin, Burns, Killian, Jansky, Moley, Kathy, Sheila. He looked out into the blackness, trembling. Moley had gone to work, crooning some old song from his vacant past. Something about having Betty Davis eyes. Who the hell was that? He was a drummer, Richard said suddenly. With that English group, the Beatles, Mick McCartney.
Yeah, you kids, Moley said, bent over his work. That's all you kids know.
-077 and counting. He left Moley's at 10 past midnight, $1,200 lighter. The pawnbroker had also sold him a limited but fairly effective disguise. Gray hair, spectacles, mouth wadding, plastic buck teeth, which subtly transfigured his lip line.
Give yourself a little limp, too, Moley advised.
Not a big attention getter, just a little one. Remember, you have the power to cloud men's minds if you use it.
Don't remember that line, do you?
Richards didn't. According to his new wallet cards, he was John Griffin Springer, a text-tape salesman from Harding. He was a 43-year-old widower. No technico status, but that was just as well. Technicos had their own language. Richards re-emerged on Robard Street at 12:30. A good hour to get rolled, mugged, or killed, but a bad hour to make any kind of unnoticed getaway. Still, he had lived south of the canal all his life. He crossed the canal 2 miles farther west, almost on the edge of the lake. He saw a party of drunken winos huddled around a furtive fire, several rats, but no cops. By 1:15 a.m., he was cutting across the far edge of the no-man's land of warehouses, cheap beaneries, and shipping offices on the north side of the canal. At 1:30, he was surrounded by enough uptowners hopping from one sleazy dive to the next to safely hail a cab. This time, the driver didn't give him a second look. "Jetport," Richard said.
"I'm your man, pal."
The air thrusters shoved them up into traffic. They were at the airport by 1:50.
Richards limped past several cops and security guards who showed no interest in him. He bought a ticket to New York because it came naturally to mind. The ID check was routine and uneventful. He was on the 220 speed shuttle to New York. There were only 40 or so passengers, most of them snoozing businessmen and students. The cop in the Judas hole dozed through the entire trip. After a while, Richards dozed, too. They touched down at 3:06, and Richards deplaned and left the airport without incident. At 3:15, the cab was spiraling down the Lindsay Overway. They crossed Central Park on a diagonal, and at 3:20, Ben Richards disappeared into the largest city on the face of the earth. -076 and counting. He went to Earth in the Brandt Hotel, a so-so establishment on the east side. That part of the city had been gradually entering a new cycle of chic. Yet the Brandt was less than a mile from Manhattan's own blighted inner city, also the largest in the world. As he checked in, he again thought of Dan Killian's parting words, "Stay close to your own people." After leaving the taxi, he had walked to Times Square, not wanting to check into any hotel during the small morning hours. He spent the 5.5 hours from 3:30 to 9 o'clock in an all-night perverto show. He had wanted desperately to sleep, but both times he had dozed off, he had been snapped awake by the feel of light fingers crawling up his inner thigh. "How long will you be staying, sir?" the desk clerk asked, glancing at Richards's registration as John G. Springer. "Don't know," Richards said, trying for meek affability. "All depends on the clients, you understand." He paid $60, holding the room for 2 days, and took the elevator up to the 23rd floor. The room offered a somber view of the squalid East River. It was raining in New York, too. The room was clean but sterile. There was a connecting bathroom, and the toilet made constant ominous noises that Richards could not rectify even by wiggling the ball in the tank. He had breakfast sent up, a poached egg on toast, orange drink, coffee. When the boy appeared with the tray, he tipped lightly and forgettably. With breakfast out of the way, he took out the videotape camera and looked at it. A small metal plate labeled Instructions was set just below the viewfinder, Richards read. 1. Push tape cartridge into slot marked A until it clicks home. 2. Set viewfinder by means of crosshairs within the sight. 3. Push button marked B to record sound with video. 4. When the bell sounds, tape cartridge will pop out automatically. Recording time, 10 minutes. Good, Richards thought. They can watch me sleep. He set the camera on the bureau next to the Gideon Bible and sighted the crosshairs on the bed. The wall behind was blank and nondescript. He didn't see how anyone could pinpoint his location from either the bed or the background. Street noise from this height was negligible, but he would leave the shower running just in case. Even with forethought, he nearly pressed the button and stepped into the camera's field of vision with his naked disguise hanging out. Some of it could have been removed, but the gray hair had to stay. He put the pillow slip over his head. Then he pressed the button, walked over to the bed, and sat down facing the lens. "Peekaboo," Ben Richards said hollowly to his immense listening and viewing audience that would watch this tape later tonight with horrified interest. "You can't see it, but I'm laughing at you shit-eaters." He lay back, closed his eyes, and tried to think of nothing at all. When the tape clip popped out 10 minutes later, he was fast asleep. -075 and counting. When he woke up, it was just after 4 p.m. The hunt was on then. Had been for 3 hours, figuring for the time difference. The thought sent a chill through his middle. He put a new tape in the camera, took down the Gideon Bible, and read the Ten Commandments over and over for 10 minutes with the pillow slip on his head. There were envelopes in the desk drawer, but the name and address of the hotel was on them. He hesitated and knew it made no difference. He would have to take Killian's word that his location, as revealed by postmarks or return addresses, would not be revealed to McCone and his bird dogs by the Games Authority. He had to use the postal service. They had supplied him with no carrier pigeons. There was a mail drop by the elevators, and Richards dropped the clips into the out-of-town slot with huge misgivings. Although postal authorities were not eligible for any games money for reporting the whereabouts of contestants, it still seemed like a horribly risky thing to do. But the only other thing was default, and he couldn't do that either.
He went back to his room, shut off the shower, the bathroom was as steamy as a tropical jungle, and lay down on the bed to think. How to run? What was the best thing to do? He tried to put himself in the place of an average contestant. The first impulse, of course, was pure animal instinct. Go to Earth, make a den and cower in there. And so he had done, the Brandt Hotel. Would the hunters expect that? Yes. They would not be looking for a running man at all. They would be looking for a hiding man. Could they find him in his den? He wanted very badly to answer no, but he could not. His disguise was good, but hastily put together. Not many people are observant, but there are always some. Perhaps he had been tabbed already. The desk clerk. The bellboy who had brought his breakfast. Perhaps even by one of the faceless men in the Perverto show on 42nd Street. Not likely, but possible. And what about his real protection? The false ID Moley had provided. Good for how long? Well, the taxi driver who had taken him from the Games building could put him in South City. And the hunters were fearfully, dreadfully good. They would be leaning hard on everyone he knew, from Jack Crager to that bitch Eileen Jenner down the hall. Heavy heat. How long until somebody, maybe a head softy like Flapper Donegan, let it slip that Moley had forged papers on occasion? And if they found Moley, he was blown. The pawnbroker would hold out long enough to take a building around. He was canny enough to want a few visible battle scars to sport around the neighborhood, just so his place didn't have a bad case of spontaneous combustion some night. Then, a simple check of Harding's three jet ports would uncover John G. Springer's midnight jaunt to Freak City. If they found Moley. You assume they will. You have to assume they will. Then run. Where? He didn't know. He had spent his entire life in Harding, in the Midwest. He didn't know the East Coast. There was no place here he could run to and feel that he was on familiar turf. So where? Where? His teased and unhappy mind drifted into a morbid daydream. They had found Moley with no trouble at all, pried the Springer name out of him in an easy 5 minutes, after pulling two fingernails, filling his navel with lighter fluid and threatening to strike a match. They had gotten Richards' flight number with one quick call, handsome, nondescript men in gabardine coats of identical cut and make, and had arrived in New York by 2:30 EST. Advance men had already gotten the address of the Brandt by a telex canvas of the New York City hotel listings, which were computer tabulated day by day. They were outside now, surrounding the place. Busboys and bellboys and clerks and bartenders had been replaced by hunters, half a dozen coming up the fire escape, another 50 packing all three elevators, more and more pulling up in air cars all around the building. Now they were in the hall, and in a moment the door would crash open and they would lunge in, a tape machine grinding enthusiastically away on a rolling tripod above their muscular shoulders, getting it all down for posterity as they turned him into hamburger. Richards sat up, sweating. Didn't even have a gun, not yet. Run, fast. Boston would do, to start. -074 and counting. He left his room at 5 p.m. and went down to the lobby. The desk clerk smiled brightly, probably looking forward to his evening relief. Afternoon, Mr. Springer, Richard smiled back. I seem to have struck oil, my man. Three clients who seem receptive. I'll be occupying your excellent facility for an additional 2 days. May I pay in advance? Certainly, sir. Dollars changed hands. Still beaming, Richards went back up to his room. The hall was empty. Richards hung the Do Not Disturb sign on the doorknob and went quickly to the fire stairs. Luck was with him, and he met no one. He went all the way to the ground floor and slipped out the side entrance unobserved. The rain had stopped, but the clouds still hung and lowered over Manhattan. The air smelled like a rancid battery. Richards walked briskly, discarding the limp, to the Port Authority electric bus terminal. A man could still buy a ticket on a Greyhound without signing his name. Boston, he said to the bearded ticket vendor. $23, pal. Bus pulls out at 6:15 sharp. He passed over the money. It left him with something less than 3,000 new dollars. He had an hour to kill, and the terminal was chock full of people, many of them Vol Army, with their blue berets and blank, boyish, brutal faces. He bought a pervert mag, sat down, and propped it in front of his face. For the next hour, he stared at it,
turning a page occasionally to try and avoid looking like a statue. When the bus rolled up to the pier, he shuffled toward the open doors with the rest of the nondescript assortment.
Hey, you!
Richard stared around. A security cop was approaching on the run. He froze, unable to take flight. A distant part of his brain was screaming that he was about to be cut down right here in this shitty bus terminal with wads of gum on the floor and casual obscenities scrawled on the dirt-caked walls. He was going to be some dumb flatfoot's fluke trophy.
Stop him! Stop that guy!
The cop was veering. It wasn't him at all. Richard saw. It was a scruffy-looking kid who was running for the stairs, swinging a lady's purse in one hand and bowling bystanders this way and that like tenpins. He and his pursuer disappeared from sight, taking the stairs three by three in huge leaps. The knot of embarkers, debarkers, and greeters watched them with vague interest for a moment, and then picked up the threads of what they had been doing as if nothing had happened. Richards stood in line, trembling and cold. He collapsed into a seat near the back of the coach, and a few minutes later the bus hummed smoothly up the ramp, paused, and joined the flow of traffic. The cop and his quarry had disappeared into the general mob of humanity. If I'd had a gun, I would have burned him where he stood, Richards thought. Christ, oh Christ. And on the heels of that, next time it won't be a purse snatcher, it'll be you. He would get a gun in Boston anyway, somehow. He remembered Laughlin saying that he would push a few of them out a high window before they took him. The bus rolled north in the gathering darkness. -073 and counting. The Boston YMCA stood on Upper Huntington Avenue. It was huge, black with years, old-fashioned and boxy. It stood in what used to be one of Boston's better areas in the middle of the last century. It stood there like a guilty reminder of another time, another day, its old-fashioned neon still winking its letters toward the sinful theater district. It looked like the skeleton of a murdered idea. When Richards walked into the lobby, the desk clerk was arguing with a tiny, scruffy black boy in a kill-ball jersey so big that it reached down over his blue jeans to mid-shin. The disputed territory seemed to be a gum machine that stood inside the lobby door.
I lost my nickel, honky. I lost my motherfucking nickel.
If you don't get out of here, I'll call the house detective, kid. That's all. I'm done talking to you.
But that goddamn machine took my nickel.
You stop swearing at me, you little scumbag. The clerk, who looked an old, cold 30, reached down and shook the jersey. It was too huge for him to be able to shake the boy inside, too. Now get out of here. I'm through talking. Seeing he meant it, the almost comic mask of hate and defiance below the dark sunburst of the kid's afro broke into a hurt, agonized grimace of disbelief.
Listen, that's the only motherfucking nickel I got. That gumball machine ate my nickel, but...
I'm calling the house dick right now. The clerk turned toward the switchboard. His jacket, a refugee from some bargain counter, flapped tiredly around his thin butt. The boy kicked the plaque steel post of the gum machine, then ran.
Motherfucking white honky sumbitch!
The clerk looked after him. The security button, real or mythical, unpressed. He smiled at Richards, showing an old keyboard with a few missing keys. You can't talk to niggers anymore. I'd keep them in cages if I ran the network. He really lose a nickel? Richards asked, signing the register as John Deegan from Michigan. If he did, he stole it, the clerk said. Oh, I suppose he did. But if I gave him a nickel, I'd have 200 pickaninnies in here by nightfall claiming the same thing. Where do they learn that language? That's what I want to know. Don't their folks care what they do? How long will you be staying, Mr. Deegan? I don't know. I'm in town on business. He tried on a greasy smile. And when it felt right, he widened it. The desk clerk recognized it instantly. Perhaps from his own reflection looking up at him from the depths of the fake marble counter, which had been polished by a million elbows, and gave it back to him. That's $15.50, Mr. Deegan. He pushed a key attached to a worn wooden tongue across the counter to Richards. Room 512. Thank you. Richards paid cash. Again, no ID. Thank God for the YMCA. He crossed to the elevators and looked down the corridor to the Christian Lending Library on the left. It was dimly lit with fly-specked yellow globes. and an old man wearing an overcoat and galoshes was perusing a tract, turning the pages slowly and methodically with a trembling, wetted finger. Richards could hear the clogged whistle of his breathing from where he was by the elevators, and felt a mixture of sorrow and horror. The elevator clunked to a stop, and the doors opened with wheezy reluctance. As he stepped in, the clerk said loudly, "It's a sin and a shame. I'd put them all in cages." Richards glanced up, thinking the clerk was speaking to him, and the clerk was not looking at anything. The lobby was very empty and very silent. Minus 072 and counting. The fifth floor hall stank of pee. The corridor was narrow enough to make Richards feel claustrophobic, and the carpet, which might have been red, had worn away in the middle to random strings. The doors were industrial gray, and several of them showed the marks of fresh kicks, smashes, or attempts to jimmy. Signs at every 20 paces advised that there would be no smoking in this hall by order of fire marshal. There was a communal bathroom in the center, and the urine stench became suddenly sharp. It was a smell Richards associated automatically with despair. People moved restlessly behind the gray doors, like animals in cages. Animals too awful, too frightening to be seen. Someone was chanting what might have been the Hail Mary over and over in a drunken voice. Strange gobbling noises came from behind another door. A country western tune from behind another. "I ain't got a buck for the phone, and I'm so alone." Shuffling noises. The solitary squeak of bed springs that might mean a man in his own hand. Sobbing. Laughter. The hysterical grunts of a drunken argument. And from behind these, silence, and silence, and silence. A man with a hideously sunken chest walked past Richards without looking at him, carrying a bar of soap and a towel in one hand, wearing gray pajama bottoms tied with string. He wore paper slippers on his feet. Richards unlocked his room and stepped in. There was a police bar on the inside, and he used it. There was a bed with almost white sheets and an army surplus blanket. There was a bureau from which the second drawer was missing. There was a picture of Jesus on one wall. There was a steel rod with two coat hangers kitty-cornered in the right angle of two walls. There was nothing else but the window, which looked out on blackness. It was 10:15. Richards hung up his jacket, slipped off his shoes, and lay down on the bed. He realized how miserable and unknown and vulnerable he was in the world. The universe seemed to shriek and clatter and roar around him like a huge and indifferent jalopy rushing down a hill and toward the lip of a bottomless chasm. His lips began to tremble, and then he cried a little. He didn't put it on tape. He lay looking at the ceiling, which was cracked into a million crazy scrawls like a bad potter's glaze. They had been after him for over 8 hours now. He had earned $800 of his stake money. Christ, not even out of the hole yet. And he'd missed himself on Freebie. Christ, yes, the bag over the head spectacular. Where were they? Still in Harding, New York, or on their way to Boston? No, they couldn't be on their way here, could they? The bus had not passed through any roadblocks. He had left the biggest city in the world anonymously, and he was here under an assumed name. They couldn't be onto him. No way. The Boston Y might be safe for as long as 2 days. After that, he could move north toward New Hampshire and Vermont, or south toward Hartford or Philadelphia, or even Atlanta. Further east was the ocean, and beyond it was Britain and Europe. It was an intriguing idea, but probably out of reach. Passage by plane required ID, what with France under martial law. And while stowing away might be possible, discovery would mean a quick and final end of the whole thing. And west was out. West was where the heat was the hottest. If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Who had said that? Moley would know. He snickered a little and felt better. The disembodied sound of a radio came to his ears. It would be good to get the gun now, tonight, but he was too tired. The ride had tired him. Being a fugitive tired him. And he knew, in an animal way that went deeper than the rational, that very soon he might be sleeping in an October-cold culvert or in a weed- and cinder-choked gully. The gun tomorrow night. He turned off the light and went to bed. Minus 071 and counting. It was showtime again. Richard stood with his buttocks toward the video recorder, humming the theme music to The Running Man. A YMCA pillow slip was over his head, turned inside out, so the name stamped on its hem wouldn't show. The camera had inspired Richards to a kind of creative humor that he never would have believed he possessed. The self-image he'd always held was that of a rather dour man with little or no humor in his outlook. The prospect of his approaching death had uncovered a solitary comedian hiding inside. When the clip popped out, he decided to save the second for afternoon. The solitary room was boring, and perhaps something else would occur to him. He dressed slowly and then went to the window and looked out. Thursday morning traffic hustled busily up and down Huntington Avenue. Both sidewalks were crowded with slowly moving pedestrians. Some of them were scanning bright yellow, help-wanted facts. Most of them just walked. There was a cop, it seemed, on every corner. Richards could hear them in his mind. Move along. Ain't you got someplace to go? Pick it up, maggot. So you moved on to the next corner, which was just like the last corner, and were moved along again. You could try to get mad about it, but mostly your feet hurt too much. Richards debated the risk of going down the hall and showering. He finally decided it would be okay. He went down with a towel over his shoulder, met no one, and walked into the bathroom. Essence of urine, shit, puke, and disinfectant mingled. All the crapper doors had been yanked off, of course. Someone had scrawled "Fuck the Network" in foot-high letters above the urinal. It looked as though he might have been angry when he did it. There was a pile of feces in one of the urinals. Someone must have been really drunk, Richards thought. A few sluggish autumn flies were crawling over it. He was not disgusted, the sight was too common, but he was matter-of-factly glad he had worn his shoes. He also had the shower room to himself. The floor was cracked porcelain. The walls gouged tile with thick runnels of decay near the bottoms. He turned on a rust-clogged shower head, full hot, and waited patiently for 5 minutes until the water ran tepid, and then showered quickly. He used a scrap of soap he found on the floor. The Y had either neglected to supply it, or the chambermaid had walked off with his. On his way back to his room, a man with a hair lip gave him a tract. Richards tucked his shirt in, sat on his bed, and lit a cigarette. He was hungry, but would wait until dusk to go out and eat. Boredom drove him to the window again. He counted different makes of cars. Fords, Chevys, Wints, VWs, Plymouths, Studebakers, Rambler Supremes. First one to 100 wins. A dull game, but better than no game. Further up Huntington Avenue was Northeastern University, and directly across the street from the Y was a large automated bookshop. While he counted cars, Richards watched the students come and go. They were in sharp contrast to the wanted facts idlers. Their hair was shorter, and they all seemed to be wearing tartan jumpers, which were this year's campus craze. They walked through the milling ruck and inside to make their purchases with an air of uncomfortable patronization and hey, old fellow, that left a curdled amusement in Richards's mouth. The 5 minute spaces in front of the store filled and emptied with sporty, flashy cars, often of exotic make. Most of them had college decals in the back windows, Northeastern, MIT, Boston College, Harvard. Most of the news facts bums treated the sporty cars as part of the scenery, but a few looked at them with dumb and wretched longing. A Wint pulled out of the space directly in front of the store, and a Ford pulled in, settling to an inch above the pavement, as the driver, a crew-cut fellow smoking a foot-long cigar, put it in idle. The car dipped slightly as his passenger, a dude in a brown and white hunting jacket, got out and zipped inside. Richard sighed. Counting cars was a very poor game. Fords were ahead of their nearest contender by a score of 78-40. The outcome going to be predictable as the next election. Someone pounded on the door, and Richard stiffened like a bolt. "Frankie, you in there, Frankie?" Richard said nothing. Frozen with fear, he played a statue. "You eat shit, Frankie, baby." There was a chortle of drunken laughter, and the footsteps moved on. Pounding on the next door up. "You in there, Frankie?" Richards' heart slipped slowly down from his throat. The Ford was pulling out, and another Ford took its place, number 79. Shit. The day slipped into afternoon, and then it was 1 o'clock. Richards knew this by the ringing of various chimes in churches far away. Ironically, the man living by the clock had no watch. He was playing a variation of the car game now. Fords worth 2 points, Studebakers 3, Wints 4. First one to 500 wins. It was perhaps 15 minutes later that he noticed the young man in the brown and white hunting jacket leaning against a lamppost beyond the bookstore and reading a concert poster. He was not being moved along. In fact, the police seemed to be ignoring him.
You're jumping at shadows, Maggot. Next, you'll see them in the corners.
He counted a Wint with a dented fender, a yellow Ford, an old Studebaker with a wheezing air cylinder dipping in slight cycles. A VW, no good, they're out of the running. Another Wint, a Studebaker. A man smoking a foot-long cigar was standing nonchalantly at the bus stop on the corner. He was the only person there. With good reason. Richards had seen the buses come and go and knew there wouldn't be another one along for 45 minutes. Richards felt a coolness creep into his testicles. An old man in a threadbare black overcoat sauntered down the side of the street and leaned casually against the building. Two fellows in tartan jumpers got out of a taxi, talking animatedly, and began to study the menu in the window of the Stockholm restaurant. A cop walked over and conversed with the man at the bus stop. Then the cop walked away again. Richards noted with a dumb, distant terror that a good many of the newspaper bums were idling along much more slowly. Their clothes and styles of walking seemed oddly familiar, as if they had been around a great many times before, and Richards was just becoming aware of it, in the tentative, uneasy way you recognize the voices of the dead in dreams. There were more cops, too. End of side 18. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.